Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. We have with us on the other line here today, Fast Freddy Markham, a man who I have had the privilege of knowing for almost two decades now. During that time, I've watched him shatter innumerable speed records on a bike made by one of the early pioneers of the modern-day recumbent movement, a man who recently passed away, the legendary Gardner Martin. And as fate would have it, the company Gardner built, Easy Racers, is now owned by the man who made the Easy Racers name famous for speed. How you doing today, Freddy?
Oh, happy to be with you today, Martin. I'm fine.
Great. Excellent. Well, listen, let's start with a little bit of background. Freddy, I don't even know this. Where did you grow up at? San Jose?
Born and raised in Los Gatos, California.
Okay. I think you might have told me that once before. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. And how long have you been riding bikes?
Well, boy, riding, I go way back. You could say almost all my life, but technically my first full season of racing was 1974, and I was certainly riding a lot two or three years prior to that.
Okay.
And so there you have it.
Okay. So before you made it over to the hill to Santa Cruz, where did you do most of your riding? Was that up in the hills, the Santa Cruz Mountains?
Yeah, pretty much in the Santa Cruz Mountains, up the peninsula and down south. I mean, it's a, you know, Northern California, the Bay Area region is a great place to, you know, not only race, but more importantly, train. And I live in Santa Cruz now, so really I'm just on the other side of the mountains. I think it was a real advantage to be able to, use this kind of terrain to your advantage. I think it helped make a better racer. And at the time, I was during the 70s, Northern California region was one of the strongest racing regions in the nation. So if you could make it in this area, you had a pretty good shot nationally at being good.
So who were some of the name racers back there? Was George Mount, anybody else that still?
Well, yeah, a lot of George Mount, John Howard, Harvey Nip.
John Howard?
Yep, John Howard.
Really?
John Howard. Yeah. We were both on the 1976 Olympic team.
Wow.
Along with George Mount and a number of other greats. Both a couple of Stettinas, Wayne Stettina.
Wayne, yeah.
And his brother Dale Stettina. Uh-huh. They were both on that Olympic team. And so, anyways, you know, you had some good trackies like Lee Barczewski. And you had a national championship win. Harvey Nitz was another big name I came out of. And these were all, you know, people like Giddy Hatton, who was a 1974 Junior World Sprint Champion. These are people we went head-to-head with here. Even Greg LeMond, who came out of this region, started racing in, like, 1976. By the time he was about a two-year-old intermediate racer at that time, he was already pretty good. By the time he was a first year junior, he was starting to be untouchable even for us. So, you know, he came out of this region, it was always very, very competitive.
So now when you say LeMond came out of this region, he was up in Reno, was he not?
That's right.
And that's considered Northern California?
Yeah, okay. The way they actually run the racing districts back then, they broke California and Nevada in half. So technically, it was Northern California, Northern Nevada, what counted as one district, and then Southern California, Southern Nevada was another district. So
we'll come back to this in a bit. But John Howard, who set a world record on a bicycle as well for speed behind a car, where did he train at in Northern California?
You know, he's pretty much down in Southern California.
Oh, okay.
Don, and that's where he ended up. John Howard was really, I think he came from a few places. He lived in Texas for quite a while.
Right.
And I think that's possibly where he was born. But, you know, right now he's down in Ensenadas, California. He runs a
school of champions.
School for champions.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, he's he's quite a phenomenal individual, no doubt. Mm-hmm. 152 miles an hour, too, was his speed.
Right. That's pretty bizarre. Now, the reason I bring that up is because you said he trained in the North NorCal region. He was Southern. Was there a Southern California? Did they come up north and race NorCal or something like that? Or how did that work?
You know, I'm not sure. Maybe I misled you there a little bit, but I didn't understand your question. No, John actually didn't. I can't say John back in the 70s raced much in Northern Cal. You know, he was one of his, at that point I was talking, he was one of the few that was on the Olympic team back then that came out of that era that we raced against a lot.
Hmm. Okay, so
that's kind of what I meant.
Got
Sorry.
It. Okay, great. Okay, so now a lot of people don't know this, but you're a family man, and you're a family man with two kids and a great supportive wife named Dee. How long have you two guys been married?
It's actually four kids. I have my stepson and three girls, but that's okay. You know, I don't expect everybody to keep up.
Wow.
I can barely.
Okay.
And it was always a compromise to hang on. And we've been married, actually, to answer your question, since 1982.
Wow.
I think I'm coming up on my 25th here. But anyways, we were together 5 years before that. So I've been with my wife, Dee, for, you know, more than half my life anyways, that's for sure. And, you know, it was always a constant juggle to divide that line between racing, training, and keeping your woman happy. And, you know, I can't say I always kept her happy, but we are still married. And ultimately, you know, I would have done anything to make sure that we stayed together. I'm glad she never really put the foot down and said, stop racing, you know, get out of this and grow up and be, you know, get a real job.
Uh-huh.
I'm thankful she never said that. Because I probably would have to just deserve that.
Right. Now, your daughter, Tanya, she raced. I know for a while she was like a little phenomenon. Is she still rolling around in speed mode on two wheels?
Yeah, I would expect her to escalate that a little bit, and maybe we'll get something more out of her. She's been a little off the back the last, you know, couple years here. I think she still holds a junior woman's record, in one of the Gold Rush Streamliners at 53 miles an hour, and at that time she was, I believe, 16 years old.
So, oh, my God.
She certainly could do a lot better than that. It just hasn't really happened yet, but she's been riding. I think she's a little more determined to do something this year, and I certainly have the resources to provide those now.
Uh-huh.
So I would expect to see her, and maybe who knows, maybe one of my other girls do something too.
Wow. Okay, well, before Gardner recruited you to speed around on his recumbents, you were already a feared racer. I know you pretty much own the Hellier Velodrome over there in San Jose, over the hill in San Jose. No one could beat you back then. At what point were you training for the Olympics?
You know, I was training for the Olympics, really. I was a first year senior racer back in 1976, 18 years old when I started training for it. I had narrowly missed the Junior World Championships the year before. I had kind of a nasty crash a couple weeks before they picked the team. It was in really bad shape. But I was hell-bent on making something, and so pretty much by... through 1975, 1976, I was concentrating on making the Olympic team as a kilo rider. And so I did make that team, and then not only that, but I was awarded a spot on the U.S. Olympic cycling team, you know, on the track squad, and managed to stay on that through 1981. And throughout that time, you know, I represented the U.S. in most international competition, both in U.S. and over in Europe, you know, did a lot of really good, you know, indoor track racing. Was mostly my specialty, at least that's what I liked the most at the time, and it was a good time, actually.
So were you racing on a wooden track?
Wooden indoor track.
Yeah. Great. How exciting. Any medals?
Medals? No, not, you know, U.S. wasn't that really good back then. You know, we had our hands full. You have to remember we had East Germans to compete with back then, and then you know, the Soviets, the Czechs, the Poles. They pretty much, we were always behind those, and that was a, you know, that was a time when the U.S. we were trying to, you know, pull up from being laughing stocks to actually being competitive, and I think we actually became competitive. We lacked a little bit. It just took a few more years for somebody to pull a medal, and but we were actually, we put on a pretty good show. And you know, when I think back, sometimes in 1976, when I was on that team and I was a 19-year-old, I remember meeting a couple of guys from, like, gosh, it must have been the Olympics, or it could have been the 56 Olympics, and I remember thinking, God, you guys, you seem so old, you know, and you must have been so slow, and God, you didn't have, like, you know, were they like solid rubber tires, you know, and you know, and no, that you were actually, and I could only imagine people, you know, from like a 1984 or a, well, not 84, but, you know, 88, 92, and I think, looking back 20 years on the 76 Olympic team, thinking, God, you guys, you have, like, wooden rims, and did you have, no, you know what, we were actually way fast, and I would say, as pretty much as athletes compared today, we're almost on a par for them. A lot of the advancements you saw in track times coming down and things like that, and speeds going up, there was a lot of technological innovations on the track bike that just plain made it aero. Right. And faster. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt some of the training techniques paid off eventually. Mm-hmm. But we weren't bad. We were way fast.
Uh-huh. Well, I think what you're probably not also kind of addressing is the fact that a good team requires that everybody on the team had to be a phenomenally fast rider, which is, I think, a lot of Lance's success is the strength of his team. Would that not be correct to say?
Well, in Lance's position, sure. That and to win something like that, you certainly have to have enough strong riders to support you and something like that. You know, Olympic track racing is a little different. It's a little more vicious in the fact that, yeah, you are a team, but except for the team pursuit squad, you know, it's pretty much an individual sport. You got the individual pursuit. You know, the kilo is pretty much an individual. You know,
right.
Sprinters.
Uh-huh.
You're pretty much on your own. Mm-hmm. You know, so we used to always have a saying that when it was Olympic year, you could crash your bike, because you know, it was always very ruthless to make an Olympic team, because it was very slim pickings. Okay.
Can you say that's what? It got a little bit garbled there. Can you say that again? To be a kilo racer, you've got to be a what now? There was a saying you guys had.
Well, you could crash your buddy.
Crash your buddy.
Because
okay.
You could. No, yeah. You could basically knock him off the bike.
Okay.
And blame it on and blame it on the Olympic year.
Uh-huh.
And blame it on the Olympic year.
Okay.
That's about how tough it was to make a team, actually.
Wow. Did they have the Pan Am Games back then as well?
Yeah, they did.
And did you race those as well?
I did not.
No? Okay. So there was the Olympics, the Pan Am Game, Pan Am's, the World?
The World Championship.
Yeah, okay, great.
I happened to be the first person to finish the 50K points race. Up until that point, U.S. riders usually couldn't qualify or even make it through the heats.
Huh.
And I finished 15th in that event out of about 40 guys.
Wow.
And that was, we covered, let's say it was 50K, call it about 31 miles, and we finished that in, I think, 1 hour and 2 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So that's a race.
Wow.
That's a race that in that 31 miles, you have a sprint about every mile. So there were 30 sprints throughout that race.
Jesus.
It was pretty grueling. And,
wow.
So I was the first American to actually qualify for it and finish that sucker, even beating out a guy named Roger Young, who was probably, arguably, the best trackie the United States has ever really produced, certainly at that time.
So at Hellier, which is a concrete velodrome, do you still hold records there?
I don't think so, except I don't hold any speed records there, but I think you could count me as nobody's won more races there than me, even though that's a number that would be just, you know, too hard to figure out what it is. But but what the amazing thing about Hellier Park was, from at least 1981 through around 1980, all through the 80s, they had a pretty good Friday night series. For a number of years, they used to draw regularly 2,000-3,000 people or more. And it was a very popular series. And so, you know, you're talking about racing sometimes four or five races a night. And there were times where I got into streaks that I didn't lose a race for weeks.
Wow.
And, you know, you're talking about winning sometimes four races on a night, all four of them, and doing that for, you know, several weeks at a time. So, you know, and I'm telling you, I rode a lot of races at Hellier Park, so it's going to be a long time before somebody actually does that. And
Wow. Well, yeah, I know people still talk about when you came to the Saturday ride here in Santa Cruz, and you came on the easy racer, that is, and no one could hang with you. They say you cruise with them through town, and as soon as you hit the open road, it was like, see ya. How often did you do that? How often did you get out there and just blow the roadies off with the easy racer?
You know,
was that just one time?
I used to take it out regularly. I didn't make such an impact at first. Usually I wouldn't ride a recumbent hunch most for many years, except for as the annual Human Powered Speed Championships would come up, I'd start, you know, cross training a little bit. Gardner would go give me a bike, and, you know, and I'd start riding it around. And I'd sometimes mix it up out there. Back then I could usually stay with them, you know, but I couldn't really, I couldn't torch them. But eventually, with that same bike, eventually I started taking it out with a bearing and a body stock on it, which turns the bike into a rocket ship. And, you know, yeah, it got to the point, if you're fit and you're acclimated to the bike like I was, and I was fairly strong at that, there's no doubt about it. I could, we have a pretty good ride out there. You know how it is. The last couple of miles are slightly downhill, and, you know, after we crest that hill, I could just sort of turn up the wick, and, you know, at about 37, 38 miles an hour, everybody starts falling off the back, and, you know, by the time I hit 40, they're gone. And you know, it was crazy. It was great because they would chase me forever. I'd look back, and there'd be like 15 guys, you know, the rest, all the other 50 were blown off, you know, miles ago.
Right.
So you're down to like 15 of the really hardcore guys that actually do some racing and know what they're doing. They're all, you know, single file, head down to the right on the stem, you know, trying to stay stay up with me. They will go for it every time. I did this for a while. I started taking it out in 1996. I started taking it out regularly. Finally, I think it was Hans Heim walks up to me and says, "You know, you bring that thing out again, we're just going to pretend you're not here." So I think I gave him a break.
Hans Heim from what, Santa Cruz Bicycles?
Right. Yeah.
Oh boy. That's what he told you, huh? Okay.
But it was a lot. It was a lot of fun. And you know, it was nice to bring it out from time to time. You know, recumbents really don't get enough respect, and I understand the deal. So. But that's why it's nice for me to come out and give them a dose of reality anyways, you know, and to be honest with you, it's long overdue. I think I'm going to have to go out and give them another taste.
All right. Great. Well, I know we've talked before. You remember when Lance Armstrong was coming up, and you knew back then he was coming through the ranks. He was going to be a phenomenon. But who were some of the other greats that you trained with? Did you... I know you're friends with Jonathan Boyer. Did you ever meet Eddie Merckx, for example?
I did meet Eddie Merckx. And, you know, I was scheduled to do a track race against Eddie Merckx and Patrick Booth. Patrick Surcoux, which was Eddie Merckx's famous six-day partner.
Uh-huh.
Eddie retired from bicycling 2 weeks before that race.
Oh, wow.
I ended up meeting Eddie anyways, and I've met him several times since, too, by the way.
He's a great guy.
Wow. I ended up doing the race against Patrick Surcoux anyways, and a few other greats like Danny Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And think people like Tony Doyle, I guess I could go on and on, Noel DeAnquiers. But anyways, those are just a few. I missed the Eddie thing. I really wish I could have said that I did that race against
Eddie. Wow. Wow, no kidding. Man.
Yeah, but Patrick Surcoux was a very close second anyway.
So, as the owner now of Easy Racers, what do you think Jonathan Boyer would say? And Jonathan Boyer, by the way, for those who don't know, was the first American to win the Tour de France. And Jonathan lives Seaside or Monterey or somewhere down there.
Down in the Sand City, I believe.
Okay,
Monterey, California.
Right.
Monterey, California, we call it anyways. And you know what? I believe they just moved their company up to Nevada, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
And I could be.
Uh-huh.
And I could be, but I hear that. Well, I'm sure, you know... If you had any advice for an aspiring somebody getting into the bike industry, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he'd give it. He did a great ride down here on Sundays, and meaning to get down there and do one with him. But Johnson, he went through some hard times, but I think he's back on track here. He always was a good guy, and I'm telling you, he did sort of pave the way for Americans for heading to the Tour de France.
How about Greg LeMond? Did you know him very well at all?
I did.
Yeah.
I knew Greg pretty well, and his father, extremely nice guy. Like you say, he came out of this region,
mm-hmm.
and for many years, believe it or not, he was quite approachable.
Mm-hmm.
He was a neat kid,
mm-hmm.
and he was by 1977. I'm going to tell you something. He was a handful. And he was the real deal as far as, he was like way fast, and he put the hammer down, and that guy started winning senior races here right off the bat, you know, which wasn't uncommon. We had some other phenomenal juniors in the pack, guys like Tom Ritchie of Ritchie Cycle.
Oh, wow.
You know,
people
don't know. Tom Ritchie was a real famous junior at the bike racer, and he was, as a junior, he won all the senior races for a number of years. When I started in 1974, Ritchie was winning senior races. He didn't even ride with the juniors anymore because they just weren't fast enough. He rode with the seniors. Guys like Gary Fisher.
Uh-huh.
Gary Fisher was another, you know, rider who went head-to-head with in most all criteriums and road races.
Hmm.
And you know, so it was a lot of good pickings around here. That's for sure.
Hmm.
And you know, and speaking of Northern California racing, it was back in the 74, 75, even up to 70, 76, you had great road races, open road races out in the hills with some just awesome climbs and descents. The California Highway Patrol pretty much put a clamp that by 1970, late in 76, turned bike racing into criterium racing almost overnight. That's what drove people like Tom Ritchie, you know, out of cycling in a sense. I digress, but there it is.
Well, can you expand on that just a little bit? You're saying that the CHP, stopped racers from being on the steep roads or something like that, and that pretty much kiboshed road racing?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. There was a number of instances where in the last tour of California they had, people I wonder, which was, they've had one before, yes, and they had it during the early 70s. I think Mike Neal, if I recall, won the last one in 1975. They held up traffic big, caused some pretty major traffic jams on some Sierra Highway. And that's what really caught the attention of the Highway Patrol. And at that time, we had all these open rolling road races. We really didn't have to, you could just plain get out there and hold what we would call today a bandit race, more or less, you know? And they had to crimp it. So, you know, they turned racing into criterium racing, but before that, we just used to have phenomenal road races, just the greatest roads.
Was this before Bob Leibold and Velo Promo?
This is before, this is exactly. Velo Promo was started with Norm Gall back in about 1979 was the first of the Velo Promo races.
Wow. Okay, well, do you still ride an upright bike, Freddie?
Well, I do. I love one. You know, you can't pry me off it. There's I live for descending myself. Like I said, I still live in the Santa Cruz Mountains. All my rides must have some kind of a climb so I can with a really cool descent in it just for entertainment. It's the reason I climb. And I just entertain myself. There's nothing like descending on a road bike. And on some of these tight, twisty roads up here, I throw it on a par with skiing, which I don't mind doing either. So, I love mountain biking. I spend a lot of time with single track trails up here. I find that each bike has a sweet spot, and when you're staying in that sweet spot, that's the bike you ought to be on. A recumbent has one too, at least for me. It may not be the bike I want to go scream down a Santa Cruz mountain on, but it sure is like a Highway 1 cruiser. And ultimately, I'm looking for... I don't mind riding a bike that allows me to ride 25-plus miles an hour with third less effort. I mean, my goal, what I think would be cool, is I'm still trying to design a bike. Maybe I can ride 30-plus miles an hour. That way I can go out and ride a century in less than 4 hours and get back and do something else with the rest of the day rather than be out there all damn day. So, I don't have time for that anymore. I still want to ride. I still want to put in the miles. So I need a faster bike to do it nowadays.
So when Gardner first approached you about being his speed racer champ, what did you think about recumbents? Took them some doing, didn't it, to convince you to ride those?
Yeah, the first bike I rode was called the belly bike. It was you laid on your stomach head first, and it was very sleek, and I rode that one because, to be honest with you, I wanted nothing to really do with recumbents as I knew one back then, the chopper style kind. It just didn't look like a race bike to me. Nobody had to really talk me into getting in the other streamline bikes and racing it, though, because I was a sprinter. I was all about going fast, and if somebody told me, at the time I was pulling a 200 time of, say, 11 seconds flat. And if somebody came along and said, well, you get in this thing and you'll do an 8-second 200-meter time, I was like, oh, yeah, well, sign me up. that's about all the arm twisting it took to get me in there. It's just history in that respect. You never had to really talk me into climbing into another streamlined fast bike again. I love it. They're different. They're different than racing a bicycle. There's something else. More like, in a sense, that you add a little more car-like qualities to the whole racing aspect. And I like it. It was always a challenge.
Well, when I'd catch you sometimes on my rides, I'd see you out there. Most of the time I saw you on a road bike. Once in a while I'd see you on one of Gardner's Easy Racers. How often was that the case? How often would you train on a recumbent?
Not very often. Let's put it this way. You have to get your body into the fittest possible shape it can possibly be in. And you can only really do that through hardcore racing. And professional racing demands so much that it really, you have to throw everything into the bike you are going to be riding and racing the most. So by the time I landed on do a recumbent race late in the year, I'm already rock hard fit from racing. All I have to do is sort of just ride one for a few days and get my abs to sitting on the seat a little bit, getting comfortable and getting a little acclimated, and I'm good to go. Now, having said that, I will say that racing, and then I'd go do a human-powered race that usually would last 4 or 5 days and do half dozen events or more, some of them pretty tough. When I was done with that, I will say in the end it made me a better road bike rider, because in all those races, and usually on the training, you're pushing, I would anyways, a phenomenally huge gear. And so by the time I'd get back to my road bike, I had more leg strength than when I started. And so that's why I learned within a number of years that it sure didn't hurt me by flipping over a little bit and riding a recumbent and doing these races. So as years went on, I also didn't mind riding a few more recumbent miles.
That wraps up episode 1 of our 2-part visit with one man remarkable for both his accomplishments and his humility. Stay tuned for part 2. To find out more about Easy Racers, go to easyracers.com. This has been NBG Director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.